Okay, so this is work that I've done in collaboration with Mina Cian, Petrini, and Tomasiello, and also with Jan Louis and Darren Waldron, and I will actually be talking mostly about this paper. So the idea is we want to compactify type 2 supergravity on six-dimensional manifolds to go back to recover six dimensions. And if we demand minimal supersymmetry to be preserved in this four-dimensional manifold, the old law says that this six-dimensional manifold has to be a Calabi-Yau manifold. A Calabi-Yau manifold is a space that has SU3 holonomy. This means there are different definitions of SU3 holonomy. One of them, the definitions that we will use, is that there is an SU3 invariant spinor such that it's covariantly constant under the Levi-Civita connection. So that's one of them. That's one of the requirements of SU3 holonomy. So this is an SU3 invariant spinor. Now we know that there is a condition that is more general than this and that still allows to preserve some supersymmetry. It's the case when there are fluxes turned on. And in that case, you have still an SU3 invariant spinor, but it's preserved in a connection that is not the Levi-Civita connection, but it's a connection with torsion. In terms of this SU3, there are still some topological remnant of this SU3 holonomy, which is the SU3 structure. So manifolds that have an SU3 invariant spinor, and such that this spinor is conserved in some torsion full connections, are called manifolds of SU3 structure. But this is in the case of, we're always looking at the six-dimensional case. And these manifolds are not Calabi-Yau. In general, they're only Calabi-Yau if this torsion is equal to zero. Now, when we do compactifications on Calabi-Yau, we know that there is a four-dimensional n equals to 2 supergravity in which the complex structure deformations span a special Kähler manifold, and the complexified Kähler deformations, so the deformations of the deformations of the Kähler form plus the B-field, they complexify, and they also span a special Kähler manifold. And if you, on top of the Calabi-Yau, you turn on fluxes, but you turn on small fluxes, so you don't look at the back reaction of the fluxes, what happens is that this n equals to 2 supergravity gets gauged, so it turns into a gauged or massive supergravity. Now the question is, what happens when we compactify on these six-dimensional manifolds that have SU3 structure but not SU3 holonomy? So they are not Calabi-Yau. What happens here? Do we still have these features? And the answer is that, in fact, it's very similar what happens when we compactify on these manifolds with SU3 structure. In particular, we will see, that we still have this special Kähler manifold, and this is still a gauge or massive supergravity. And this is all given by Hitching functionals. So Hitching functionals here appear very naturally to describe these special Kähler manifolds. Special Kähler manifolds for the complex structure deformations and the Kähler deformations. So the outline of the talk, I will first introduce the SU3 structure. Then I will say a few words about generalized complex geometry, which is the natural framework to discuss this. This generalized complex geometry, you will hear more about it later in other talks. Then I will introduce the Hitching functionals. Then we will see that we get special Kähler structures, and we will see that there is an n equals to 2 version of the superpotential. In the end, talk about n equals 1 superpotential, and then conclusions. So the idea, we are always, if we split the 10-dimensional manifold into a 4-dimensional manifold times a 6-dimensional manifold, if we want to get an action that is similar to 4-dimensional n equals to 2 supergravity, then we need that the supercharges must be well-defined on this 6-dimensional manifold. So we need to have supercharges that are well-defined in this 6-dimensional manifold. And this means that this 6-dimensional manifold must admit globally well-defined spinors. Otherwise, they are not well-defined supercharges. And this means that the manifold should have reduced structure. So the structure group of a manifold is the group of transformations required to patch the orthonormal frame bundle. And we have that if a manifold is Riemannian, the structure group is automatically SOD. If a manifold is spin, the structure group is automatically spin D. But we need something smaller than SOD. We need to have these globally well-defined spinors. We need that the structure group reduces to a subgroup of SOD. There are equivalent definitions of G-structure, so the manifold admits a G-structure if equivalently, well, the structure group reduces to G, so the group of transformations required to patch the orthonormal frame bundle is not just SOD, but it's a subgroup of SOD. Or another equivalent definition is that there are globally defined non-vanishing G-invariant tensors, or there is a globally defined non-vanishing G-invariant spinor. So these are equivalent definitions of G-structures. And in particular, we're interested in the case where this group G is SU3. So this is a relevant case that appears in six dimensions. So we look at SU3 structure in six dimensions. The presence of an SU3 structure allows to split, to break the representations. So vectors, two forms, three forms, and spinors come in different representations of SO6. And we can break these into representations of SU3. So for example, a vector in the six splits into a 3+3 bar. So in particular, having an SU3 structure means that you can have an almost complex structure that allows you to define complex coordinates, and so these six decomposes into holomorphic and anti-holomorphic vectors. A two-form in the 15 decomposes like this, a three-form decomposes like this, and a spinor decomposes like this. In particular, you see here there's a one, so there's a singlet, and this is a spinor eta that is globally defined and is SU3 invariant. There's also a singlet here, which is a fundamental two-form, which can be written in terms of bilinears of the spinor in this way. So it's equivalent, so this two-form is a globally defined, non-vanishing SU3 invariant tensor. And there is this singlet here is nothing else than the holomorphic 3-0 form, which can also be written in terms of bilinears of the spinor. So it's equivalent to have the spinor or to have these two forms which are given as bilinears of the spinor. So this is, you might recognize these two formulas. This is exactly the same as in Calabi-Yau. But the difference is that in Calabi-Yau is a space that has SU3 holonomy, and this spinor is covariantly constant in the Levi-Civita connection. Now we're in a space where this is not true. The spinor is covariantly constant in a torsion full connection, which means that in the Levi-Civita connection, this is non-zero. So if you insert this in here, what you get is that this phi and this omega are not close. So this is the same as Calabi-Yau. There is a fundamental two-form. There is a holomorphic 3-0 form, but they are not close. And the measure of how much they are non-close is measured by the intrinsic torsion. So we can decompose dj and d omega into representations of SU3. And so we write dj as a part that contains omega, a part that contains j, and a part that doesn't contain omega or j, and the same for d omega. So, and these W1, 3, 4, and 5 are the torsion classes. This W1 is a singlet. It's the one that you have to remember. Then there are these other torsion classes, which are, this is a vector. This is a 6+6 bar. So this is a 2-1 form and primitive. This is in 8+8. We don't need the details of this. We need to remember that there's a singlet here. And when there are other torsion classes. Now, to define the SU3 structure, so we said the SU3 structure is defined by giving the spinor singlet or by giving J and omega. So we use J and omega to define the SU3 structure, but actually you can define the SU3 structure in terms of real forms. So J is a real form, but omega is not a real form. But if you take just J and rho, where rho is a real part of omega, these two define an SU3 structure. So we don't need the full omega, but we just need the real part of omega. Now, not any J and rho will define, not any two-form and three-form will define an SU3 structure, but these two-form and three-form must be stable. This means that they live in an open orbit under the action of GL6R. So this means that each element in a neighborhood of rho is GL6R equivalent to rho. So we can map the full neighborhood of rho with this GL6R transformations. So two stable forms define an SU3 structure. Well, there's a condition for this. Not any two stable forms will define an SU3 structure. We'll see later that there's a condition that J and rho must obey to define an SU3 structure. And this is, well, this is work of Kitching. And the natural framework to discuss this is generalized complex geometry, which was developed by Kitching and Gualtieri, who's here in that field. A physical interpretation for stability. More than this, we will see. Well, we'll see later another definition which is even more mathematical. So I'm not sure it will it will help. That's another condition. No, one condition, you need that the stabilizer, so the dimension of if they are stable, so if each element in a neighborhood of rho is GL6R equivalent to rho, then the orbit of rho is equal to the dimension of the three forms, because you can get any three form by acting on GL6R. So if you take the dimension of GL6R and you subtract the dimension of the orbit, you get the dimension of the stabilizer. So those are the elements that leave rho invariant. And the elements that leave rho invariant, so if you do that subtraction, it gives you that J is stabilized by an SL3C, and rho is stabilized by, J is stabilized by NSL6R, so J defines a, symplectic, now we get it. J is stabilized by a symplectic 6R, and rho is stabilized by NSL3C. So they both together define an SU3 structure, which is sort of the subgroup of this, of this and this. But I don't know if that's more intuitive for you. You need the orbit to be maximal dimension, which is in this case the dimension of the orbit has to be the dimension of the three forms. If it's not stable, it doesn't define an SL3C structure, which is what you need to start. It doesn't define an SU3 structure. You need this to define a symplectic 6R structure, and you need this to define an SL3C structure, so such that together they define an SU3 structure. And the conditions on each of these separate to define these structures is that they are stable. I don't know. Maybe there is some more intuitive understanding of this. Yeah, by this GL6R transformation. Yeah. Now this is very natural in the context of generalized complex geometry, and since there will be more talks about it, I will say just a few words that I need. The first idea is of generalized complex geometry is to generalize usual differential geometry. So usual differential geometry deals with a tangent bundle whose sections are vector fields, and then separate entity deals with a cotangent bundle whose sections are one forms. Now the idea is of generalized complex geometry is to do differential geometry on T plus T star, so treat this as a single bundle whose sections are vector fields plus one forms. So now we don't treat T and T star separately, but we treat the single bundle T plus T star. And the first thing about this is that there is a natural metric on T plus T star, which comes for free, so you don't have to do anything. There's this natural metric, which is given a vector field plus a one form and another vector field plus a one form. You can contract this one form along this vector field and also this one form along this vector field, and this gives a scalar. So in a coordinate basis, this metric has DD signature. In a coordinate basis, it looks like this. So this is a natural metric on T plus T star. Now the structure group of T plus T star is SO66, or spin 6-6 if the manifold is spin. And, well, to start with, the structure group of T plus T star is SO6-6. Now, we will work a lot with pure spinors, the notion of pure spinors. So let's look at the action of Clifford 6. So on T, if we have spinors, we have the action of Clifford 6. On T plus T star, there's the action of Clifford 6-6. The algebra of Clifford 6 is this. Of Clifford 6-6, the algebra is like this. So you have these big gamma matrices with indices up, which anti-commute. The gamma matrix is with indices down that anti-commute, and then you have this non-trivial anti-commutator given by this. So here you don't, this gamma and this gamma are independent, so you cannot raise and lower the indices with a metric. So you have here 12, here you have 6 gamma matrices, here you have 12 gamma matrices. There is a representation of this algebra in terms of forms. Here you can take, for example, this gamma m given by dc wedge. Sorry, this should be dx. Dx wedge, the real dx wedge, plus a contraction. If you take this representation, insert in here, you get this metric from a wedge and a contraction. You get this, you get back this metric. So this solves, this obeys this algebra here. Here, what the representation that you can take is gamma m being represented by dx wedge, and then gamma m down being represented by a contraction. So this also dx, dx, and the commutes, and these two give a delta. And we will use this notation, gamma sigma with big sigma, to denote both gamma m down and gamma m up. So this sigma runs from 1 to 12. Here we have a Clifford vacuum given by a spinor. And the way to construct a Clifford vacuum of T plus T star is by taking products, these tensor products of two spinors. These tensor products of two spinors, if you use fierce identities, they are given by these bilinears, the sum of these bilinears. So now take the tensor product of eta plus with eta minus, and what you get is omega, because you get the bilinear of eta plus. If you take eta plus and eta minus, the only bilinear that is non-zero here is the one with three gamma matrices, and you get omega. So omega is a Clifford vacuum for T plus T star. This spinor eta is a pure spinor on spin 6. It's annihilated by half of the gamma matrices. So we can say that eta is plus, plus, plus. It's annihilated by all raising operators. So it's annihilated by half of the gamma matrices. So this is a pure spinor. Similarly, omega here is annihilated by half of the gamma matrices. For example, gamma I with an index I, a holomorphic index here, which is DCI, annihilates omega, and a gamma I bar down annihilates omega. So gamma is annihilated, so there are three gamma matrices here, three gamma matrices here. Gamma is annihilated by six gamma matrices, or half of the 12 that we have. So is annihilated by six gamma matrices. So omega is a pure spinor of Clifford 6-6. You can construct a basis of spinor acting with eta. On eta, you act with the gamma matrices that don't annihilate eta, and you create a basis of spinors. Here you can do the same, acting with all gamma matrices that don't annihilate the spinor. For example, gamma I bar, which is DCI bar wedge, has here an anti-holomorphic index, so you get a 3-1 form. 3-2, 3-3, and the same. So when we talk about spinors of Clifford 6-6 or spin 6-6, they are equivalent to PQ forms. So there is an isomorphism between spinors of spin 6-6 and PQ forms. Now here, the irreducible representations are the wild spinors, or the spinors that have a definite chirality. Here there are also two irreducible representations, which are given by S plus minus, where plus minus can be thought of the chirality on spin 6-6, and S plus is the space of even forms, and S minus is the space of odd forms. So the space of even, we can think that the space of even forms has positive chirality, the space of odd forms has negative chirality. So omega, our pure spinor here, belongs to S minus. You can see it's a it's a tensor product of a positive chirality and a negative chirality spinor, and this, so this belongs to S minus. Here, there's also, so here we have eta plus and eta minus, so we have another pure spinor. And here we tensor eta minus with eta plus. We can also tensor eta plus with eta plus. And what you get is e to the ij, which is this sum of forms. So when you tensor eta plus with eta plus, you get here the term that has no gamma matrices gives you this one. The term that has two gamma matrices gives you this j. With four gamma matrices, we get, you get this j squared. With six, you get this j cube. So this is e to the ij. It's also, it's another pure spinor of spin 6-6. So this is also annihilated by half of the gamma matrices. It's not as easy to see as omega, but this works. And these are six gamma matrices, so e to the ij is a pure spinor of spin 6-6. Now, the existence of a pure spinor here reduces the structure group to SU3. If we have an SU3, if we have a globally defined non-vanishing spinor, this reduces the structure group to SU3. Here, the existence of a spinor reduces the structure group to SU3-3. So we start, the structure group of T plus T star is SO6-6, and the existence of a pure spinor reduces it to SU3-3. Now, something that we will need a lot is the inner product. In when you take two spinors, you can take this inner product. This gives you a number. Here, you can do the same. So phi and rho are two spinors, and we are going to define this inner product. I will tell you what this epsilon is. We're going to define it through this pairing that is called Mukai pairing. And what it says, it takes the wedge product of phi and rho, and from that wedge product, it takes only the top form, so only the sixth form. This means that it's equal to, so you take the sixth form of phi and the zero form of rho, this gives you a top form, then the four form of phi and the two form of rho, and etc. And another thing that you have to do is change the sign of some of the forms here. So you change the sign of rho 2, and you change the sign of rho 6. And this you do in order that it's anti-symmetric. So then, this should be a 4. So 5-4 which rho 2 is equal to minus 5-2 which rho 4. So this is anti-symmetric in phi and rho. So this is a pairing of two spinors with positive chirality. A spinor with positive chirality and negative chirality gives you zero because you cannot get a sixth form out of an odd form and an even form. But so these are Mukai pairings. But with two spinors of negative chirality, you can do the same. So you do the wedge and you look for the top form, for the sixth form, and you also change this sign here. So these are the Mukai pairings. And now they are all six forms. So this is a six form. A six form is proportional to a number times a volume element. So if this is the volume form, the inner product actually takes the number out of it. So choose a volume form, and then you will say the inner product of this is the number. So this is, I don't know, 2 times my volume form, so the inner product of this will be 2. That's the idea. The existence of two pure spinors here on T will reduce the structure group of SU2. So we say one spinor reduces the structure group to SU3. Here, this will reduce the structure group of SU2 if the two spinors are never parallel. So this we won't need. We won't be talking about SU2. But here, the existence of two pure spinors reduces the structure group to SU3 times SU3 if you have this condition. So this inner product of phi minus and phi plus with the gamma matrix, because otherwise it would be zero automatically. If this inner product is equal to zero, then this reduces the structure group to SU3 times SU3. Now, if you insert for phi minus omega and for phi plus into the ij, what you get is this condition. This is the known condition for having an SU3 structure. So j and omega cannot be anything, but they should obey this orthogonality condition. So in general, given two pure spinors, the structure will be reduced to SU3 times SU3 if this condition is true. So now we want to perform a compactification on a manifold with SU3 structure, which means that we want to get an effective theory of the light modes. But here we run into a problem immediately, which is if we remember that J and omega are not closed but are given by this, then for example the Laplacian of J would be sort of related to squares of the torsion times J. So this means that the torsion give masses to the deformation, some of the torsions give masses to the deformations of J. So the formations of J are massive, and the distinction between light and heavy modes is not clear because this mass is given, this mass is the torsion which is given by the geometrical data, so it's given by the metric itself. So the distinction between light and heavy modes is not very clear. So we don't want to, what we will do is go through an alternative route, which is not to compactify or not to truncate the spectrum. So we will choose not to truncate the spectrum at all, so we will consider all the spectrum, we won't compactify. So we won't say that the 10-dimensional manifold is a product of M4 times Y. But what we will demand is that Lorentz invariance is broken into a 4-dimensional, so spin 1-3 times spin 6. So we don't do product manifold, but we do break Lorentz invariance in this way. So this means that the tangent bundle of the manifold, of the 10-dimensional manifold, is equal to this SO13 vector bundle plus this SO6 vector bundle that we call F. If you look at the supercharges, which are in the 16 plus 16 into B or 16 plus 16 bar into A, this breaking of Lorentz invariance induces a breaking like this. So the 16 breaks into 2-4 plus 2-bar, 4-bar. Now, what we will do is require that this tangent bundle admits an SU3 structure. So we break Lorentz invariance, we have this spin 6, and then we will require that this tangent bundle admits an SU3 structure. When this happens, we know that this 4 decomposes into a 1 plus 3. So we have this further decomposition of the 16. The same can be done for the other 16 or for the 16 bars. Just put some bars somewhere. And you can see here that 8 supercharges are singled out. 8 supercharges, so 4 here and 4 here, are singled out because they have a spinor, they have a singlet as sort of internal spinor. It's not internal because it's not a product, but they are singlets under this, well, SU3 structure. So 8 supercharges of the original 32 are singled out. So what we want to do, the original type 2 theory is formulated, we can say that it's formulated on a supermanifold that has 10 bosonic dimensions and 16 plus 16 fermionic coordinates in the case of 2B or 16 plus 16 bar. And what we want to do is, so we demand, again, we demand that we break Lorentz invariance, so we demand the splitting of the tangent into this, and then we demand that this admits an SU3 structure. So this is equivalent to saying that there should exist a supermanifold of this supermanifold that has still 10 bosonic dimensions, so we are still in 10 dimensions, but the fermionic coordinates are given by these 8 supercharges that are singled out. So instead of the 16 plus 16, we have this 4 plus 4. So we don't compactify, we don't look at the theory in 4 dimensions, we look at the theory in the whole 10 dimensions, but it's just in this subset. So we will only consider this subset of the supercharges, so a sub-supermanifold in which the fermionic coordinates are in this 4 plus 4. Yes. Yeah. I mean, yes. First, it's not known what the moduli of this SU3 structure is, but there is a way to perform some kind of truncation and say that sort of torsion and fluxes are the masses related to torsion and fluxes are small, and you sort of relate your deformation problem to the deformation problem of Calabi-Yau. It's similar to the deformation problem of Calabi-Yau, but now some of the modes are massive. This can be done, and indeed we did that after doing this, but I won't talk about that. So we want to reformulate the theory on this sub-supermanifold. So again, this is 10-dimensional theory, but it has these 4 plus 4 supercharges. So this theory on N has 8 supercharges, it has spin 1-3 preserved. So although we want to show that although this theory is in 10 dimensions, it has the same structures as 4-dimensional n equals to 2 supergravity. Because it has spin 1-3 preserved and 8 supercharges, it has the same structures as 4-dimensional n equals to 2 supergravity. In particular, it has special Kähler manifolds for the complex structure deformations. So the complex structure deformations here span a special Kähler manifold. It has a special Kähler manifold for the complexified Kähler deformations, and Kähler, because this manifold, well, it's not a manifold again, but this spin 6 might have, the complex structure might not be integrable, or the symplectic structure might not be integrable, so it wouldn't be Kähler, but they're still called Kähler deformations. So we want to show this, and then we want to show that there is an n equals to 2 superpotential. So there is a sort of gauge or massive supergravity given by this n equals to 2 superpotential. So this is what we will do. And let's look at the deformations of the SU3 structure. So we want to show that the deformations of the SU3 structure, or the deformations of the matrix, span special Kähler manifolds. So first, let's look at the deformations of the matrix. So we have this decomposition. This is the SU3 representation, and this is a 4-dimensional spin. So this is a singlet of SU3 and a spin 2. And in particular, we want to look at these, which are spin 0 in the 4-dimensional manifold. So these metric deformations are in the SU3 representations 1, 6 plus 6 bar plus 8. And these are 21. And they parameterize the coset of GL6R divided by SO6, because the metric is SO6 invariant, so these deformations parameterize this coset. Now, what we want to do, instead of considering the metric deformations, we want to consider the deformations of the SU3 structure, so deformations of J. And what we do is decompose these deformations, delta J into lambda J, plus V, this should be a contraction, I don't have that in this latex. So V contracted with rho plus K. So this is, lambda is a scalar, V is a vector, and K is a two tensor in D8. So these are the deformations of J, and the deformations of rho similarly can be decomposed in this way. So this lambda is related to this lambda because we're going to demand that J with J is equal to 3/2 of omega with omega bar. So this lambda, this deformation lambda is the same. Here we get an extra scalar, the same form V, and a 6 plus 6 bar. If you count here, you have 28, which is the dimension of GL6R divided by SU3, because this defines an SU3 structure, so these deformations parameterize the coset GL6R over SU3. So if you compare these two, you have 7 extra deformations here, which are gamma and V. And these are deformations of the SU3 structure that leave the metric invariant. So these are sort of extra degrees of freedom that we have if we consider deformations of the SU3 structure instead of considering metric deformations. So indeed, the deformations of the metric can be given in terms of the other deformations, so Km, and lambda. So deformations of the metric, and we parameterize with lambda, K, and M. So we want to consider, so we say instead of considering metric deformations, we will consider deformations of the SU3 structure, so deformations of rho, J, and then both together. And we want to show, or Kitchen shows, that these deformations of rho and J span special Kähler manifolds. So this was a long introduction. A bit more than an introduction. And again, T and T plus T star. Now we are calling it F. We want to compare a couple of things. Here we have a spinor. On T plus T star, the spinors are these forms, so are in the space of positive and negative chirality, spin 6, 6 spinor, which is identified by the even and odd forms. And the same way, so first we divide this into biro representation, so we divide the two chiralities, but there are also Majorana vile representations, which correspond to even another spin or well, forms which are real. So this would be the equivalent to Majorana representation. They are chiral, and even form belongs to S plus, and if it's real, it's vile and Majorana. Again, this defines an SU3 structure. Now each of these spinors phi defines an SU3 structure if it's stable. So we say that this is the condition for stability. Out of this spinor, we construct a two-form on T or on F. Out of this spinor, we can also construct a two-form using these gammas, so these indices running from 1 to 12. So we construct this generalized two-form. Now here, if the spinor is normalized, then you do this contraction, and this gives you 6. In this case, this doesn't necessarily give 12, and in particular, well, you cannot fix the spinor norm because the phi wedge with itself, so the norm of phi, if you the internal product of phi with itself is equal to 0 because this internal product, this which is a wedge, is antisymmetric. So there's no way to fix the normalization in the same way that you fix it here. So in particular, this is not necessarily 12. So now we will forget about T, we will always work with F plus F star. And Hitchin constructed this function, which is this contraction divided by 12. And he called this lambda. And this is a function of phi. So this is a bilinear in phi. And so here comes the other property of stable forms. Phi is stable if this is bigger than 0. So he showed that this you construct this is a number, so you construct this number by the function of phi, and phi is stable, so the condition, the definition that we gave of stability before is equivalent to lambda being greater than 0. So now we construct a space of forms such that lambda is greater than 0, and this is the space, so this is a space of stable spin 6-6 spinors. So the space of stable spin 6-6 spinors are those such that lambda is greater than 0. Now, so phi belongs to S plus or minus. This can be identified with a space of even or odd forms on T. So the dimension of the space of even forms in 6 dimensions is 32. It's the same as the dimension of the space of odd forms. So this is a subset in this 32-dimensional space. And again, well, if these spinors are stable, this reduces the structure group to SU3-3. So one stable spinor reduces the structure group to SU3-3. Now we want to show that there is a special Kähler structure on this space U. So this is a space of a stable spinor and its deformations, and we want to show that this space is indeed special Kähler. So there is a special Kähler structure on U. So this means there is a complex structure, a symplectic structure, and a prepotential. So I hope this is not too heavy. I promise it's only 2 transparencies. So to do that, the basic object that appears is this Hitchin functional. This Hitchin functional is the square root of, this is basically, so it's the square root of lambda, so this was J by sigma, this was J by sigma. So this H, Hitchin call it phi, but here I call it H because there are too many phis. So this is a square root of, so basically it's the square root of lambda, but we take it to be a 6 form. So instead of taking the number here and the number here, you take the 6 form here and the 6 form here. So this is, the number here is J by sigma, and this is proportional to a volume form. And the same here. So this thing inside the square root is equal to the number lambda times epsilon tensor epsilon. And when you say that you take the square root, actually what you do is take the square root of this lambda and then multiply by epsilon. So this is the Hitchin functional. And remember, the space of stable forms is a space where this shape by this lambda is greater than 0. So this square root of lambda is a real number. And this is a function of phi. Again, lambda is a function of phi. So this is a Hitchin functional. For example, let's look at phi equals rho, which might sound familiar for the people that have read some of these topological M theory papers. When you're doing this, this J pi sigma, remember these are wedges and contractions, so this is something like this, contracted with this, something like this. So you have a wedge here and a contraction here. In terms of indices, which is sometimes more familiar to us, the index structure of this is something like this. So this is a 6 times 6 form. So it's something like this. Now, if you want to construct H, what you do is contract this with 2 epsilon tensors, take the square root of this number, and then multiply by epsilon by the volume form. So maybe this looks familiar to you, this Hitchin functional with 4 rows, and it has appeared in the physics literature many times. Now, given this Hitchin functional, we define phi hat to be the derivative of the Hitchin functional with respect to phi. If you do this, so you do this derivative with respect to phi, what you get is this. This phi hat, which is the derivative of H with respect to phi, this is another element in S plus minus. So here there are two gamma matrices acting on phi, so we don't change the chirality. If phi was positive chirality, then phi hat is going also to be positive chirality. So this is another element of S plus minus. Now, phi hat is d H d phi, and H is homogeneous of degree 2 in phi. So you see here that H has 4. So this row is phi. H has 4 phi, so this H is homogeneous of degree 2 in phi. This means if it's homogeneous of degree 2 in phi, it means that this derivative is equal to 2 times H divided by phi, roughly. So this means that H is 1 half of phi hat, written like this. And now remember that phi hat is a function of phi, because phi hat is defined by this. So now we want to combine phi and phi hat. They are both real spinors. This is, phi was a real spinor, and phi hat is also a real spinor, and we combine it in terms of complex spinors. Now, if you look at this, it's not that hard to show that half of the gamma matrix is annihilate the spinor, so this is a pure spinor. So that's a way to construct a pure spinor out of a stable spinor. So you start with a stable spin 6-6 spinor, which is real, construct this Hitchin functional, take the derivative of the Hitchin functional with respect to phi, and then this defines another spinor. You combine them into a complex spinor, and this is a pure spinor. So for example, again, if you take phi to be rho, which is a real part of omega, you do this, you derive with respect to phi, and what you get is the star of phi. So this, you get basically some 1 epsilon and this rho, so you get the star of phi, which is the imaginary part of omega. So the combination of phi plus I phi hat is nothing than omega. So that's how you construct the pure spinor out of omega. So actually, the imaginary part of omega, the SU3 structure is just given by this real spinor. The imaginary part can be constructed from the real. The imaginary part of omega can be constructed from the real part of omega. Promises one more heavy transparency. So we want to show that there is a special Cayley structure on this space. This is the space of stable spin 6-6 spinor, and this is a 32-dimensional vector. So this is a subset of a 32-dimensional vector space. This is a vector space, and this is, so S plus and minus is a vector space, and U is a subset of a vector space. So we can identify the tangent space of U at the point phi with S plus minus itself. In particular, what this means is that phi can be thought as a coordinate on U or as a vector field on U. In particular, if you think of phi as a vector field on U, it has this index alpha, which runs from 1 to 32, because this is the dimension of S plus minus. So this index runs from 1 to 32. So for example, if this is a three-form can have elements 1, 2, 3. The element 1, 2, 3 would be alpha equals 1, for example. The 1, 2, 4 would be alpha equals 2. The 1, 2, 5 would be alpha equals 3. And there are 32 possibilities. If you consider all forms, there are 32 possibilities for indices that you can have. So this is this index alpha. The symplectic structure in this space is just given by the spinor norm. So remember, this is if you take the wedge, if you take this Mukai pairing of two spinors, this gives a fixed form. So this is proportional to the volume. And if you take the number, this is a good symplectic structure. It's antisymmetric in phi and rho, and in particular, you can write it this way. Phi and rho are two elements in here, so they have this index alpha. So this inner product, you can write this way. And this is a symplectic structure. So the symplectic structure in U is easy to construct. It's just given by this once we define what is this inner product. Now the complex structure is more involved. The complex structure is given by the derivative of phi hat with respect to phi. So this has indices alpha and beta. This has an alpha up and a beta down. Now, if you remember that phi hat was the derivative of the Hitchin functional with respect to phi, then you get second derivatives of the Hitchin functional with respect to alpha and beta. So the complex structure is given by these second derivatives of the Hitchin functional. And defining phi hat, which will be the derivative of h with respect to phi hat. So h is a function of phi, but you can also write h as a function of phi hat. And if you make this derivative, it's not hard to show that this is just minus phi. And using this, you can show that this squares to minus 1. And now this is a 32 by 32 identity, because again, we're in this space. And I'm not going to show it, but it's not very hard to show that these symplectic and complex structures are integrable. So we have an integrable symplectic structure and an integrable complex structure. And out of them, you can construct a metric, which is just take this complex structure and the symplectic structure and take this inner product, and this gives the metric. Remembering that this I is equal to this, what you get here is, so this W and this W go away, and you get that the metric is given by second derivatives of the Hitchin functional. And actually, since there is a complex structure, we can use complex coordinates. And this metric is 1-1. So what do you learn from here? That the Hitchin functional is nothing but the Kähler potential in this space. So the Hitchin functional is the Kähler potential. The Kähler potential, so the Hitchin functional is here we're taking, so the Hitchin functional was a fixed form, so this is a bit of abuse of notation. We're taking the number that multiplies the fixed form. So this is given by W of phi hat. So remember the Hitchin functional, we said it was phi wedge phi hat. And in terms of the complex spinor, this is IW of phi big phi phi bar. And you can take Darboux coordinates, I'll go fast on this, but you can show that they are actually these complex coordinates, and you can write this in this way, and there is a prepotential. So the space is spatial scalar. So we have a complex structure, a symplectic structure, and a prepotential. Oh, sorry. I know. We went back. What happened? I don't know. This is. So there is a complex structure, the symplectic structure, and the prepotential. So the space of stable forms is spatial Kähler, and the Kähler potential is given by the Hitchin functional. And actually, one can show that one can construct a local spatial Kähler geometry, which is modeled out by this rescaling. And the Kähler potential is given by the log of the Hitchin functional, so log of phi w phi phi bar. It looks the same as in Calabi-Yau. Well, we will see now the Kähler potential, which is actually is exactly the same. For example, if phi is equal to rho, we want to see that the special Kähler structure, so there is a special Kähler structure in the space of stable rho, and that's the space of complex structure deformations. So the Hitchin functional, we said, looks like this. The pure spinor you can construct doing the derivative of the Hitchin functional with respect to rho, and the pure spinor is omega. and the Kepler potential is minus log of h. This is minus log of this, and this is just taking the number of omega wedge omega bar. So this looks exactly as in a Calabi-Yau. So this W of omega omega bar, if you multiply by the volume form, then this is just omega omega bar. So the Kepler potential is the log of omega wedge omega bar. So this is exactly as for Calabi-Yau. So actually we don't need SU3 alone on me to have this spatial Kepler and to have this Kepler potential, but it's enough to have SU3 structure to have a Kepler potential that looks like this. Well, but so the SU3 structure tells you that there are eight supercharges which are singled out, and then these eight supercharges indeed, one can look at this spinor, which is the real part of e to the ij. This is some complex number, and the deformations of this, the space of stable phis, has also a special Kepler structure. This is a special Kepler structure for Kepler deformations. The Hitching functional, you do something similar, and what you get is j with j with j. If you do the pure spinor, what you get is the imaginary part of e to the ij, so you combine them and it gives you this e to the ij, a number times e to the ij. The Kepler potential is minus log of h, so it's equal to this. And if you multiply by a volume, this is nothing but j with j with j. So the Kepler potential looks exactly as in Calabi-Yau. Yes? It's not close, right? The structure looks the same, but omega is not necessarily close. Yes, and the same for J. Yes. I'm not sure I will. So we said that the moduli space of the formations of J and rho are special Kepler, and we want to show that there is an n equals to 2 superpotential. I'm not sure. I will go fast. So torsion and fluxes generate a scalar potential. In particular, in n equals to 2, the potential is given by this, roughly speaking, is given by the supersymmetry transformations of the gravitino, the geishino, and the hyperino. But the gravitino transformation contains all the information about the potential. So it's the same as in n equals 1, the supersymmetry transformation of the gravitino is proportional to the superpotential, and the superpotential, well, plus the Kepler potential, obviously contains all the information about the potential. Here in n equals to 2 is the same, and you can write this, the bosonic part of the supersymmetry transformation as this, where this A goes from 1 to 2, so this moves in FU2R. This S is a gravitino mass matrix, so the mass matrix for the gravitino looks like this, and in terms S and its derivatives give you all the information about the potential, so this S we refer to as the N equals to 2, what people refer to as the N equals to 2 superpotential. In terms of, you can split it using sigma, poly-sigma matrices, so these are poly-sigma matrices times an epsilon tensor, so you can split it in using these three real potentials, which are called Killing prepotentials. They're called Killing prepotentials because they tell you which isometries are gauge. If you have these Killing prepotentials, some of the isometries will be gauge, so there will be some Killing vectors, and so that's why these are called Killing prepotentials. And in n equals 1 language, this P1 plus IP2 is in n equals 1 superpotential, and P3 is a D term. So this SAB contains information about the n equals 1 superpotential and the D term. So we want to compute the supersymmetry transformation on this manifold N. And I will go fast. The idea is that you split the 10-dimensional spinor into something in a spinor, a four-dimensional spinor times an internal spinor. When you do this splitting, you get a part that includes the singlet and a part that includes these triplets. And this is what you're going to define to be your four-dimensional gravitino. Again, this theory is in 10 dimensions, but the part that contains an internal singlet is what you define a four-dimensional gravitino. So there's a subtlety. So we, given the supersymmetry transformations, which look like this, you apply this to extract the singlet, you apply this projector, and you get these bilinears. Because applying this projector here, you decompose this epsilon, there's an eta inside, an eta here, and you get these bilinears. Now, these bilinears, so this is omega, these contractions, can be written in terms of this Mukai pairing. So the Mukai pairing of H3 and omega is the volume form times this scalar. So all terms actually can be written in terms of Mukai pairings, and what we got is something like this. So P1 plus IP2 is this, the derivative of E to the B plus IJ, this is in 2A, P3 is the flux is in 2A, the Ramon-Ramon flux is in 2A times E to the B plus IJ, and here you get a similar expression for P1 plus IP2, and P3 here is given by the flux is in 2B and omega. So this depends on e to the b plus e to the ij, which is also a pure spinor. So if phi is pure, e to the b phi is pure. And one thing that you can see is that P3 always has this form. So f plus here, the Ramon-Ramon fluxes are even. So you get a Mukai pairing with an even pure spinor. Here they are odd, you get a Mukai pairing with an odd pure spinor. So there is this mapping of f plus and f minus, which is a mapping of phi plus to phi minus, and this is exchange of two pure spinors, which is the action of mirror symmetry, and you will hear more details about it. And well, also in the Ramon-Ramon sector, you see some exchange. They will talk about it. Now, well, then I won't have time, or maybe I'll show you just the result. So the idea is this is an n equals 1 workshop, not an n equals 2. So we want to break the SU2R into a U1. And in particular, we want to look at, so first we are looking at the sub-supermanifold with four supercharges. And we want to look at another sub-supermanifold of this that has only, sorry, this has 8 supercharges and another that has only 4 supercharges, and look at the n equals 1 superpotential. So we can obtain the n equals 1 superpotential from here. The only trick is that this is P3 is not just a D term, but this depends on how you break SU2 into U1. So basically the P along the U1 is the one that gives you the D term, and the other P is combined into an N equals 1 superpotential. And you parameterize how you break from N equals 2 to N equals 1 by these two complex numbers, A and B, where this epsilon is the N equals 1 supersymmetry parameter. So the superpotential will depend on these numbers, A and B, and we got this superpotential looks like this, where this W is distortion, so it's the derivative of e to the ij and omega, which is equal to the torsion class W1. So this is a singlet. H here is H3 and omega. Fa is F, the sum of the Ramon-Ramon fluxes into A with e to the I. With e to the b plus ij. Into b, we got a similar expression where this is fb is f omega. And this alpha and beta are these angles that are defined from a and b. So this superpotential depends on two angles which parameterize the breaking of SU2R into U1. So these two angles tell you which is the direction in SU2 space that you preserve, that you single out. This gives you how is the n equals 1 embedded into the n equals 2. And this contains all the cases known so far. So, for example, if you put this, you get this Wukov-Raffa-Witten superpotential. So this is G3 with H. If you put these other numbers here, you get this heterotic superpotential. So the superpotential when there is torsion. So this is for the torsionless case when W is 0. So you put this and you get W equals 0. And this is the superpotential for the case where there are no Ramon-Ramon fluxes. But this is a general n equals 1 superpotential for manifolds with SU3 structure. So, short conclusions. So AMB tell you how to break from n equals to 2 to n equals 1. For example, if you want to preserve if you want to have a conformal Calabi-Yau, or you want to have this, if you want to have imaginary self-dual fluxes, the choice that you need to make is exactly this. The choice that you need to make for AMB, the way that the n equals to 2 is broken to n equals 1, is precisely by this combination. The same if you want to have vacua that have, so this vacua that this vacuum that Strominger, this superstring with torsion that Strominger discussed in 86, also correspond to this choice of alpha and beta. So this tells you how the conserved n equals 1 spinor is embedded in terms of these two n equals to 2 spinors. You get something else, and then. It's just a continuous parameter, then what might happen is that there are no vacua for that continuous parameter. So you get, it's a continuous parameter, so there are these two angles, it's a continuous line, and then you have to see what happens, if there are vacua or not. So you get the superpotential, and then you have to do derivatives and see if there are vacua for in the general case, they are functions, yes. In the general case, there are functions. There are numbers for these particular cases, but in the general case, there are functions of internal space, right? Yes. So, we discussed type 2 theories on manifolds admitting an SU3 structure, and we said there's a special, the moduli spaces span special Kähler manifolds, and we talked about the n equals to 2 superpotential. We said the Kähler potential is given by the Hitching functional. We discussed the n equals to 2 superpotential, and we say it's given by inner products of pure spinors and flux or torsion. And the same for the n equals 1 superpotential. It's also given by this pure spinor of this inner products of pure spinor and flux and torsion. And it also depends on these two angles, which define the breaking of SU2R into U1, or how this U1R is embedded into SU2. So the teaching functionals are in general generalized complex geometries at the core. I hope I have convinced you that they are at the core of n equals to 2 or n equals 1 compactifications of type 2. And if I haven't, there will be more upcoming talks on this subject. Thank you.